escaped Nazi Germany and lost many of your family in the Holocaust. Please remind our listeners about the key facts in the Skokie case and why, as a Jew, you decided to defend the right of American Nazis to march in the predominantly Jewish village of Skokie, Illinois.
The Nazis who wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois, were a small group who had tried to demonstrate in a park in Chicago that divided a black neighborhood from a neighborhood that was predominantly East European in provenance. And they were restricted from doing so by a federal court. While they were restricted, they tried to remain active, and they notified a number of communities around Chicago that they would march in those communities. Most of the communities ignored them. Skokie responded, in effect, saying, "Don't you dare come here." And Skokie passed a series of ordinances to make it impossible for the Nazis to march in Skokie. And because of that, the ACLU decided to represent the Nazis, to uphold the principle that any group expressing any point of view can exercise free speech in the United States. The principle at stake is simply that government officials, whether it's Donald Trump or anyone else, may not decide who...
To WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Framing is a presentation of information. What's said and how it's said. Whose voice is heard, who's not. The thing that was so noticeable in my study of the coverage of the cultural heritage destruction in Artsakh and in Gaza was that invariably in the corporate and legacy media reporting, values that were missing were human rights, humanitarianism, and oftentimes journalistic ethics.
That's Misha Girakulis. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Misha Girakulis on media framing of cultural destruction, Artsakh and Gaza. Artsakh, also known as Nagorno-Karabakh, is an historic Armenian area located in the Caucasus Mountains. In 2023, Azerbaijan invaded and ethnically cleansed the millennial-old Armenian population. The so-called civilized West looked the other way. Looking away has been harder to do in Gaza because of the enormity of the Israeli attack and the sheer scale of death and destruction. The Israeli goal in Gaza and the Azerbaijani goal in Artsakh is cultural and physical erasure. Both Artsakh and Gaza are reported as though they're just happening in a vacuum. By not providing context and background, journalists are guilty of media malpractice. Our guest today is Misha Girakulis. She's a human rights journalist and critical media literacy expert. She's managing editor of Project Censored, the Media Watch and Education Organization. She's the author of Media Framing and the Destruction of Cultural Heritage, News Narratives about Artsakh and Gaza. She spoke in Teaneck, New Jersey in mid-September 2025. The moderators were Mark Mamigonian and Henry Terrio. And now, Misha Girakulis.
As an American of Armenian heritage, the events and after effects of the 1915 Armenian genocide are imprinted in my DNA. Stories conferred to me early in life instilled an acute awareness of matters of truth and justice, cultivated an affinity for those suffering displacement, dispossession, and marginalization, and set me on a path toward journalism, even though I didn't know it back then. Journalism, it said, provides history's first draft and is duty-bound to set the record straight, which made it all the more difficult to reconcile how or why the Armenian genocide went unacknowledged by much of the world for so many decades. News coverage of the Armenians has existed across a spectrum, from the early 20th century dispatches of the Armenian massacres in Ottoman Turkey to contemporary reporting on the indigenous Armenians in Artsakh, the Armenian enclave situated within Azerbaijan. I explain to people who don't know about the region, I call it Artsakh throughout the book rather than the internationally known, the more internationally known name, Nagorno-Karabakh. Similarly, media coverage of Palestinians in Gaza, the occupied territories in Israel, from the creation of the Israeli state to present day, differs by outlets and nations. Like the Armenians, Palestinians have undergone repeated waves of social exclusion, displacement, and homeland dispossession, owing to the settler colonial practices of occupying forces and imperialistic geopolitical goals. Armenians and Palestinians are among the largest and longest running diasporas in the world, with more people living outside their respective homelands than within the borders. Both groups still experience the lingering impacts of the Ottoman Empire's rule over the region that we now consider Turkey, Armenia, Palestine, and Israel. So as I was thinking more about how to put this material together, I paid a visit to the Armenian Museum in Watertown. And I was standing in front of the collection of the French Armenian Legion. And my focus settled on a map of a battle in which the Armenian French Legion, the Armenian Legion, had been sent into Palestine by the French to liberate the Palestinians. And I was really struck by the shared history, by the fact that Armenians and Palestinians are indigenous to this part of the world that is just in perpetual conflict. And as I was standing there looking at this map, I thought of the words of a journalist who I've long admired, who's now passed away, Robert Fisk. He was a Middle East correspondent, British Middle East correspondent, who wrote, you know, prolifically on the Middle East, spent quite a lot of time there. So I'm just going to read this because I think it also helps set the stage. So Robert Fisk wrote in 2018 that the First World War was a time of promises and lies. The promises came first in 1916. The British told the Arabs they would have independence. In 1917, they told the Jews they could have a homeland. And the French told the survivors of the 1915 Armenian Genocide that they could return to liberate their homelands in eastern Turkey. Then came the betrayals. The British created an Arab legion to fight the Ottoman Turks for independence and a Jewish legion to fight the Ottoman Turks in Palestine. And the French created an Armenian legion, an offshoot of the French Foreign Legion, to fight against the Ottoman Turks for Cilicia. The Arabs lost Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon. The Jews did not get all of Palestine. And the soldiers of the Armenian legion, having helped to liberate Palestine, were abandoned amid the ashes of their own burnt cities. Among the indigenous peoples of the Middle East, the Armenians were the most traduced of all, since they recovered not a square inch of their land. To be a loser doesn't get you much purchase in the history books. To be a loser twice over turns you into a curio. We're talking basically about the media's role in the depiction of cultural heritage, but also its role in constructing history, or how states in particular use the media to construct history. This is just that quote that's attributed to Philip Graham from the Washington Post. It says, news is a rough draft of history. The main questions that I thought about throughout the process of research were, how does media coverage of crises impact public opinion and outcome? Have human rights and/or humanitarian standards and journalistic ethics informed reporting? And have the media responsibly informed the public on the rights violations? The concepts that came out of the study are actually applicable beyond the context of Artsakh and Gaza. Those concepts, which we'll get into a little more, are looking at news frames, looking at news values, the devices that determine newsworthiness, what makes the news. Why is this important? It's important because our historical memory is at stake. The historical record is at stake. And the way news is constructed and presented has such a bearing on public opinion, on our values, on the decisions that we make, particularly at the voting ballot. And looking at the way cultural heritage is covered speaks indirectly to that formation of history. Media framing. Framing is a presentation of information, what's said and how it's said. If we think about a picture frame or a camera frame, there's what's inside that frame, and then there's everything that's outside of the frame. So we have to think about both things. In terms of what's in that frame, you know, we have to think about the language that's used, the tone. Is the voice passive or active? How is this information presented? Because it's always going to be presented at a particular slant or perspective. The news values that show up within the frame are what are determining or telling the public what's worthy of knowing. And then we think also about representation, who's included, whose voice is heard, who's not. This is something that journalism schools go over quite a lot. There are 8 conventional news values. These all play into what is considered newsworthy, what is thought about when constructing a news story. The thing that was so noticeable in my study of the coverage of the cultural heritage destruction in Artsakh and in Gaza was that invariably, especially in the corporate and legacy media reporting, values that were missing were human rights, humanitarianism, and oftentimes journalistic ethics. At the end of the study, one of the conclusions I came to is that these values should be included in reporting: human rights, humanitarianism, journalistic ethics, cultural heritage. Why is cultural heritage so important? Because after World War II, when the nations of the world were coming together to say, never again, these horrible atrocities, we can't ever let this happen again, different organizations under the umbrella of the UN were being developed, UNESCO as one of them, the United Nations Educational Scientific Cultural Organization, realized that cultural heritage is an extension of basic human rights. It's how we know ourselves. It's how other people will come to know us. It's a form of self-power. It's a way of relating. It can be used as means for goodwill, creating deeper understanding among peoples who are different. And it's also a form of diplomacy. So cultural heritage is enshrined in Article 27 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and therefore protected, theoretically. I used certain lenses to do my analysis of the media coverage. One of them is a concept called critical media literacy. It goes beyond just basic media literacy, and it comes from critical pedagogies, namely the work of Paulo Freire, and it looks at media ownership, production, distribution, who's represented in the media. Critical media literacy examines the construction and presentation, very similar to what we were talking about with framing, as well as content and context of stories. I also use the lens of Orientalism, the work of Edward Said, obviously, which is this colonial dichotomy worldview that posits Western culture as superior over Eastern. And this is important because this shows up in the way media covered cultural heritage. These two lenses actually are quite similar when it comes down to the line of inquiry. And these are just questions that both ask. There are questions around power, around who's profiting from the story. These are questions about who is centered, who is silenced, who is missing. Is there anyone being harmed from the way a story is being told? Another form of analysis was looking at a story in something that comes out of reading literacy, which is mirror story and window stories. A mirror story, it's like a story that's held up in front of me. I can see myself in the story. It's very familiar. It often reinforces what I already know, what I already believe, the opinions that I already hold. And in a negative sense, it could be a negative, confirms a bias that I may already hold. A window story, by contrast, is something that's different. It's unfamiliar to me. It's a story that is showing me something that I don't already know. It could be challenging what I already know, what I believe, the opinions that I hold. The one problem or negative with a window story is it depends on who is doing the telling. If it is in the case of the material here, Gaza and Artsakh, if the story is being told by someone other than those persons, people who maybe are in the West and have never been to those places, then there's going to be a filter over that story. So these are just all things that I was thinking about that were informing my analysis. This is something that I share with students, the red flags to look for when consuming news, whether reading or watching a video, listening to a radio report. Some of the red flags are to look for missing context. Does a story explain historical or root causes of a conflict or problem? Does it illuminate potential geopolitical problems, geopolitical relationships, power dynamics? Is the story giving one side, and is that side just from an expert or a military official? Or is it offering multi-perspectivity by talking to people who are actually involved in the actual story? Does the story illuminate and include the story of people being harmed or affected by a situation? Or is it just an outside view? Is the story being depicted as just too complex or too far away to be understood and therefore reducing its importance? Also, things to think about are questions of voice. Is it passive voice or active voice? Are there claims being made? Are those claims attributed to someone? If there's a perpetration happening, is it anonymous or is there attribution? Does the story generalize or downplay damage? Like the situation with, I was looking at the destruction of cultural heritage. So many stories that I came across were just sort of generalizing, downplaying the harm, depicting cultural heritage destruction as just an unavoidable collateral damage in a conflict. Something else to look for is both sides' presentation when the situation is clearly unequal, the idea of false equivalence. look for photos and headlines that are dramatic but don't have proper context. Another red flag is when very protracted situations such as Gaza or Palestine and Israel or Azerbaijan and Armenia are presented as just sort of, you know, happening out of the blue, just one-off situations rather than there's this whole long history. Stories that are overly simplistic and just depict us versus them or good versus evil, that's a red flag. The use of absolutist language, always and never. And another red flag is what the organization that I work for refers to as junk food news, just distractions, irrelevant. But another red flag is rhetorical device known as semantic infiltration. This is something that actually gained a lot of popularity during the Cold War. For example, pulled from a Reagan speech in reference to the Soviet Union, the media would repeat the phrase evil empire. And so this idea of semantic infiltration is the use of negative language by an opponent or even a perpetrator that seeps into the language of those telling the story, even if it's completely not in their best interest to use that sort of language. So these, I wanted to just show a few of the headlines of the stories that I analyzed just to kind of point out some of these red flags. And this is regarding Artsakh, and it says that there's been a blast, a depot blast, not attributing the fact that it was blown up by Azerbaijani forces. This is an example of a false equivalence. The Armenian and Azeri soldiers clash. They just clash. And one other, this is just to show the distraction. This was from Le Monde. And the article is about how Hollywood feels about Israel and Hamas. I'm not sure that that's important, that we need to know how Hollywood feels, but there it is. So fast forward, what I was finding in these studies of the media coverage in both cases, Artsakh and Gaza, similarities between Azerbaijan and Israel. Both have purposely created bipolarized societies. They have both minoritized and scapegoated particular ethnic groups, Armenians and Palestinians. Both nations depict a false image of an ethno-state, this pure Jewish state, a pure Azeri Turkish state. Each has used the media to help manufacture an enemy within. And they both have used the state, they've used their state control over the media and propaganda to further these ideas. In media terms, borrowing from the title of a classic book by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky from 1988 is the idea of manufacturing consent. This is using propaganda and these other rhetorical devices in the media to create worthy and unworthy victims. Those victims of crimes and conflict, the victims who are losing their cultural heritage, who are, you know, those minoritized, scapegoated citizens are not worthy victims. A couple of examples of how each nation has used media and state-sponsored communications to further their depiction of their minoritized citizens. This, probably a lot of people in the audience has seen this. It was a commemorative stamp from 2020 that the Azerbaijani state created. It's a map. There's a man in a hazmat suit using some sort of insecticide to spray down Artsakh. furthering that image of the Armenians as, you know, the vermin, subhuman. Similarly, the Palestinians are often referred to as animals, dehumanized, considered a blight on the state. Ultimately, the findings of the media coverage of both of these situations reinforced and corroborated what we have already been reading for years from Dr. Bedros Demirtosyan, who's, I'm sure many of you know, is an extremely informed Middle East historian who did help me with the organization of this material. But what he's been finding for years is that the perpetrators in both of these situations, Azerbaijan and Israel, enjoy impunity, due in large part to the ongoing narrative that they are necessarily fighting an enemy within. Azerbaijan and Israel portray themselves as existentially threatened, which is their justification for breaching human rights standards and international law. The media reporting often frames these situations as just too complicated, just too far away to be understood by the average person, which has served to stall a humanitarian response. Any kind of action, humanitarian action, has been depicted oftentimes, not always, but often, as futile or just, you know, too little, too late. And then those depictions feed into public apathy. When media reports are divorced from the historical context, from the geopolitics, when these situations are reported, you know, as one-offs, as though they're just happening in a vacuum, not part of this protracted events, the public is not moved to respond. This, I bring up a book written by Ben Bakdikian, Armenian, obviously, and also a very respected media expert. He first wrote this book, The New Media Monopoly, in 1983. It was reissued and updated in 2004 and has just stood the test of time as being one of the most respected media critiques of our era. But he said, media power is political power, and it is. And I think that's just something to always hold in our minds when analyzing media, when reading or consuming any media. It doesn't have to be all negative, though, because I know what I've presented so far sounds negative. And actually, a different style of reporting can help bring about different outcomes. So there's the traditional content model reporting, which is, you know, usually shorter, breaking news, it's happening quickly. It's very good at documenting things that are happening over a timeline, but it's often repetitive, kind of parroting one another, and it's published quickly. So it serves a purpose for sure. Then there's the impact model journalism. And journalism is a little different from reporting. Both have their place, but journalism tends to be longer form. It takes longer to do. It contextualizes timelines, usually, almost always, actually involves an investigation. It involves analysis. It involves providing insightful commentary. And it does take more money and longer to publish. Oftentimes, it's done by independent outlets rather than the corporate press. Media, in the best of circumstances, is public service. It's a public good, and it can be a guide dog as much as it can be a watchdog. We think of media, I mean, oftentimes as the fourth estate, as providing a check and balance to our government, to governments around the world. There, I came away with four ways to help shift the direction of conventional reporting. One is really obvious. It's just adhering to best practices. Serious journalists and reporters too, and really any media professional, abides by the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. And it is an American code of ethics, but it's known and used around the world. There are four pillars. The first is to seek truth and report it. Second is to minimize harm. The third is to act independently. And the fourth is to be accountable and transparent with sources and with audiences. The second is to borrow from humanitarian journalism, which is including that human rights framework that just makes an assumption that all of humanity has worth. There are no worthy and unworthy, valuable, invaluable. Everyone is starting at the same level. Another way to change the reporting is to, I'm borrowing from a conflict reporter named Amanda Ripley. She wrote a whole book on how to report on conflict and crisis, and she uses the phrase complicate the narrative. I'm using the term oversimplification, but for our purposes today, I have sort of oversimplified her explanation of complicating the narrative. And that is, as a reporter, aim for impact rather than just getting your content out there. Really aim for impact. Break the conventional framing. Expand that lens. Show more than what we're just typically seeing. Refrain from fatalistic language and reporting problems as though they're intractable, which oftentimes in reading from the corporate press, anything to do with Artsakh or Gaza, intractable. It's just, you know, not much that can be done. And then lastly, spotlight what is possible, because there are always possibilities. And then this last frame is borrowing from the Solutions Journalism Network, which, full disclosure, I'm part of. Solutions Journalism says that reporting can be strengthened when we not just report on problems, but illuminate a response, provide evidence for what works and what doesn't work, offer insight, and show how solutions can be repeatable in other places, and be transparent about any kind of limitation or shortcoming in a solution. And with that, I will stop. Thank you for letting me share that. I feel like I kind of whizzed through some heavy material, but happy to answer any questions or provide any other information.
Misha, thank you so much.
You're listening to Misha Gerakulis on Media Framing of Cultural Destruction, Artsakh and Gaza. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
I wanted to ask one question, Misha, about one of the red flags that you had listed, which are all obviously very much spot on. And I think the first one was that the article or piece lacks context or omits necessary information. In reading, for example, much of the media coverage of the Artsakh conflict and ethnic cleansing and its aftermath, because I know the subject fairly well, I could discern when necessary information was being omitted or context was not being provided or insufficient context was being provided. But I know the subject. Now, when I'm reading about a different topic or another person is reading about the Artsakh conflict, they're not necessarily able to be aware of the missing context or necessary information that's being omitted. So how do you essentially teach the skill of picking up on that when you aren't necessarily well-versed in the topic that you're reading about?
It requires having an inquisitive mind. It requires making time to learn, because news is coming at us so fast and furiously, and it takes discipline and effort to take a pause and to do what, you know, in basic media literacy, they say, oh, do lateral reading, you know, read multiple sources. Again, it's time consuming and it's challenging. I wish there was an easy answer or a quick fix. I don't think there is. Maybe this is where AI can be useful. Maybe this is where, someone opens up ChatGPT and says, show me an array of perspectives on this particular topic. But really, it's kind of hard to shortcut taking the next step to learn more.
We all experienced the frustration and anguish of reading these accounts during the war and its aftermath. And I think it was the subject of at least a couple of programs that we did during that time period. And it was truly maddening. Perhaps it should also have been, and I hope it was, instructive as we are reading other accounts of other conflicts of a similar nature, perhaps in other parts of the world, and we come to realize that there's very likely similar absent context and absent necessary information in those as well. So if it had any benefit, perhaps it trained us as mostly us Armenians, to be more critical in our approach to all news accounts.
It seems like the analysis that you've given, you know, applies across a lot of issues. I think immediately of things like how sexualized violence is covered, typically, how immigration is being covered, I think, today. And I think this is true also of Gaza and Artsakh. There's a need for investigation, but there's also sort of a clear perpetrator victim or something like that. This is not just a mutual kind of situation. And we see a lot of reporting that obviously the kind of ways that you talked about misframing this, I think, really is helpful. Here's the question. Do you see people in the field today emerging? Do you see them as having the same concern for this kind of journalistic ethics and this kind of work of getting at beyond the kind of easy, well, we hear different voices and we're going to report all of them, to that more journalistic level you were talking about? Is that a value in journalism the way that it was maybe 5 decades ago or 3 decades ago? Or is something changing? And if it is changing, what can we do?
I will tell you, from what I'm seeing, journalism programs nowadays are not teaching history. They're not teaching the history of journalism. They're not teaching about muckraking. They're not teaching that journalism is a public service. At one stage was held up at the first as the fourth estate. I don't think that people have a clear understanding of what the First Amendment is, or that freedom of the press and freedom, the right to information, is enshrined in Article 19 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. You know, I think it's more of an American issue. I was at a conference back in March with a lot of European journalists, and they were actually expressing shock at the differences, the lack of historical knowledge in journalism is similar to the way history and civics are not being properly taught in K-12 schools. I mean, I know, like, at the organization that I work for, we really do our best to teach the history, to bring the history forward, but it's an effort. Ben Badikian was writing about the corporatization of the media, you know, 20 and more years ago, and it's worse now. It's monopolized, but that's also where the money is. And so people who get into journalism or media, let's say they want to become a media professional, they want to be in front of the camera, that's a whole different ball game. And the way they're going to make money is through the corporate broadcasting, or, I mean, that's all changing now too, obviously, but there's more money there than in the independent presses.
One of the things that's interesting is you highlighted the issue of public good related to the ethics. And one of the things we're seeing right now, I think, is a flipping of that use of the public good in order to censor journalists and other people in our society, you know, because they disagree. I won't get too political here, but they disagree with an established power, and therefore their actions are inherently not in the public good. And so I'm wondering, that double-edged issue is so complicated. It reminds me of Terence Day Prey's classic on governing narratives and things like that. I was wondering, how do we deal with that when the tools that we think will be helpful in challenging the suppression of good journalism and so forth are actually the ones that are being used against good journalism?
I wish I had a solid answer. I was at a book festival and a conference this past weekend, and one of my colleagues wrote a book called Let's Agree to Disagree. And we were just kind of joking and saying, if only we could, you know, just have these more norm-centric conversations where we could sit down with people who know different things than we know, who hold different opinions, you know, with an open mind, without demonizing difference. We're at this weird stage in humanity where we're, I mean, that's where we are. We're so polarized. You know, we were talking about capital and corporatism, but I'm also thinking about social capital. You know, the idea that we're all in this together, and that's being eroded too when we're being divided.
If I can ask one last question, I wanted to bring it back to the cultural heritage issue for a moment. Cultural heritage seems like a difficult topic, you know, at the sort of beginning to get interest in. Like, you know, even relative to direct human rights violations and things like that. It seems to me there's a real question in journalism, and there's an ethical question of whether, yes, we want to do stories that are of interest to people. That is, we want to, if people are asking questions, we want to have good journalism that can actually start to address those questions. But at the same time, it seems like we also want to have journalism that does stories on things people aren't thinking about. Mm-hmm. Do you see people as naturally curious enough where journalists can really bring into focus issues that otherwise people would say they have no interest in? And I'm thinking cultural heritage falls into that. It's really important, but it's not something people talk about much at all. So I was wondering if you could comment on that, what your sense is, you know, what you see as the possibilities there in changing how we think about journalism, or should we, and so forth.
I want to say that part of the problem is that the media that gets the most attention is the loudest and the most repetitive. And now we have this influencer culture that dominates, and this, you know, the internet that we thought was going to be democratizing, and social media that we thought was going to balance out the corporate press, has just become another form of gatekeeping. And so again, it's forcing us, if we will allow ourselves, if people have that luxury, if they can break from the stress of everyday life, to think differently, to think about other things. I mean, I think that this is the beauty of art and cultural heritage. It's another way of looking at history. It's another way of communicating. It's another way of learning about difference. I'm heartened by the fact that there are cultural editors. You know, I'm on the board of a cultural literary magazine, the Markaz Review. It just seems as though these sorts of places, outlets, publications, journalists, they're fewer and farther between, or they're just not as obvious because the other loud, repetitive voices, the influencer voices, they get the most oxygen. They get the clicks, they get the likes, they get the dollars that follow.
So when you were writing this book, did you stop to ponder the irony that for the roughly 15 minutes that the Artsakh conflict commanded the attention of the world in 2023 was ended by the Hamas attack on October 7th, followed by the attack on Gaza that has followed since. There were literally like a few days when the mainstream media was paying attention to the horrible events in Artsakh and the pictures of fleeing Armenians, and then it was gone. And the fact that you've brought these two subject matters together in the book, if this irony lingered in your mind, or maybe did more than linger in your mind.
It absolutely did, and thank you for asking that. I mean, there were many times just during the research where, I mean, I felt sick to my stomach. It was hard to do. What I found was that, yeah, Artsakh was a blip in the media. And Gaza is very repetitive. The coverage is not the same. The coverage of Gaza is largely one-sided in the corporate press. Artsakh, that was, you know, a blip on the radar and gone. The corporate press did a bit more reporting. I'm thinking specifically of the New York Times after the fact. My view of that was like, oh, they're just doing this as a, you know, CYA. They're just, oh, we covered Artsakh. You see, there it is. Okay, well after the fact. But all of that seems to point to the geopolitical relationships, the agendas, what's taking precedence behind the scenes, and the media is just carrying out those geopolitical aims. And the truly insightful, accurate, ethical, investigative, contextualized reporting was done by independent journalists who were on the ground, who were putting their lives at risk and probably not making a dime for their work.
Actually, if I could follow up, because in the U.S., we've obviously had a big discussion about defunding, for instance, NPR and PBS and so forth recently. And when I think again about how coverage happens, it does seem that historically the public media has a broader sort of interest range. You know, there's almost a value of bringing to light what isn't necessarily on everybody's mind, partly because it's supported media and you can send reporters to do something that isn't necessarily going to get advertisers on CNN or whatever it is. But the flip side of that, when I'm thinking about, you know, and I'm very aware of what Mark was saying about that coverage shift, you know, which is not atypical, right? I mean, editors are making decisions about what they're going to cover, what's going to be, you know, so they do that. But the flip side of this now seems to be, yes, in a good situation where there's a kind of tacit agreement at the governmental level that a public media benefits everyone somehow, that it's better to have that. It's like having a democracy, even if you lose the election, is better than not having one, right? Which is now called into question. I think we all used to think that, but now there's a real question about it. But it seems to me that this last few months has shown us a particular vulnerability with public funding, which is if it's shut down drastically, that immediately changes the media landscape, and a lot of news availability that was there can be taken away very quickly. It's almost like a blackout of key news. Where do you come down on that? You know, is governmental funding ultimately a good thing? Is it a double-edged sword? You know, does it really result in a broader coverage of issues, or does the public media eventually sort of imitate or follow the corporate media?
Excellent questions. One of the things you're speaking to is a phenomenon of news deserts. That, you know, the great swaths of areas in this country that no longer have local news. And now with the defunding of PBS and NPR, and they're certainly imperfect, but they were at least some semblance of a public good in that even if the local news coverage isn't spot on, the NPR and PBS are providing educational programming in places that would not have access, particularly in rural areas. The Medill School has shown that most of the places where news deserts are in the Deep South, where there are already problems, and in the Midwest, you know, rural areas. So that's one problem. Government's never been pure or, you know, nonpartisan, but now it's extremely partisan. And so if public media were continued to be funded by the current administration, what would that look like? I mean, I talk a lot about the Pacifica News Network. You know, that started in after Vietnam by a pacifist in Berkeley, California. It is radio and now podcast. The Project Censored show is on that network. There's no corporate funding, there's no governmental funding, and it's community-based radio, and it exists across the country, and it's available online as well. So there are alternatives that are not influenced by government. There's that. There is, so we have a colleague at the Annenberg School at UPenn, University of Pennsylvania, Victor Picard, and he is putting forth a new idea for public media that would utilize some government funds, but not entirely. And he's conceptualized a way to make it much less partisan than it would be as things stand now. So, I mean, people are at least having the conversation and thinking about ideas. It's not just all, oh, this is terrible, what are we going to do? There, I do believe that in dark times, creativity is sparked. Look at the beauty of Armenian music and poetry and art that has emerged, you know, from genocide. So, I mean, we are confronting really hard times. There's no denying that. I just think that we have to think differently. And we also need to act in solidarity.
The last question from the audience. What words of encouragement would you give to media contributors who are in our audience today to stay the course with their own ethical journalism and critical analyses of corporate journalism, especially those who are unwelcome or censored in non-alternative media?
I'm a Gen Xer, and we Gen Xers, we saw the fall of the Berlin Wall, and I think it inspired a certain idealism. And my undergraduate studies were in international development and conflict resolution. And I, you know, at that stage, multi-track diplomacy was very hot. And then I went on to study education later, and I mention all of that to say I'm a real believer in multi-perspectivity, in conversation, in having hard conversations, in being true to oneself. I don't know that anybody gets into journalism to try to make the big bucks. You know, journalism is different from wanting to be a media professional. So, you know, journalists who feel deflated, it's hard. I think it helps to communicate, to be in contact with one another, to talk about what we're experiencing, to take inspiration from sources where we can. Something that I find helpful with cultural heritage is turning to the arts, because there are many ways to tell stories. It doesn't have to just be hard investigative reporting. It might be through poetry. It might be through performance art. Comedians, there are many ways to communicate. And I think if we can inspire one another and remember our humanity and remember some that we are part of a greater whole, and to keep learning, those are hopefully helpful tactics to stay the course.
You were just listening to Misha Jirakulis on media framing of cultural destruction, Artsakh and Gaza. She spoke in Teaneck, New Jersey in mid-September 2025. The moderators were Mark Mamigonyan and Henry Terrio. Misha Jirakulis is a human rights journalist and the author of Media Framing and the Destruction of Cultural Heritage, News Narratives about Artsakh and Gaza. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a Ben Bagdikian archive. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we're podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Misha Jirakulis on Media Framing of Cultural Destruction, Artsakh and Gaza, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Lucinier Kasparian. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with oud virtuoso Richard Hagopian performing Sude Sude. It's all lies, lies, lies.
If we choose life, if we choose love, community, and reverence, we will not only avoid self-destruction, we will usher in a future of immeasurable promise. That is a future worth working for with all our heart and soul. We will prosper together in our care for life, or we will perish together in our exploitation of life to make money for the already morbidly rich. choice is ours.
That's David Corton, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features David Corton on the future of humanity. We are at a dangerous moment in human history. Philosopher and thinker David Corton says, we stand at a crossroads between two possible futures. In one future, we continue on the path of separation and likely bring the human chapter of creation's journey to an untimely end. In the other future, Corton says, we find our rightful place as responsible, loving members of the Earth community in an ecological civilization, helping to guide creation's journey into a future of harmony and new possibilities. The choice could not be more profound. It is, in a real sense, a test of what being human truly is. Our guest today is the visionary intellectual David Corton. For several decades, he was an insider in the development establishment. He worked for the Ford Foundation and USAID and taught at Harvard's Graduate School of Business. Having severed his ties to the past, today he is a leading voice for economic and social justice. He's the author of many books, including When Corporations Rule the World and Agenda for a New Economy. He spoke in late August in Bainbridge Island, Washington. And now, David Corton.
We live in a time of profound challenge and opportunity. The signs of crisis are all around us. A mounting perfect storm of climate disruption, ecological degradation, war.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are so